Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to 1202, the Human Factors Podcast, the podcast that covers all things about humans, technology, and particularly the bits in between.
And welcome to this episode of 1202, the Human Factors Podcast, with me, your host, Barry Kirby. As many of you will know, my area of expertise, or I guess my area of comfort when we're talking about human factors, is really the defence and the future technology sector. But after taking the challenge of the Institute's president this year at the ergonomics conference to go and look at something new, then I spent a significant amount of time in the health sector of listening to all sorts of arguments around safety one and safety two and all these sort of things that really give me an insight into how clinicians and other experts within the health domain are really trying to solve some of those human factors problems within the domain. But I always find it quite surprising that an organization or, you know, an entire sector that is based around making people better still seems to struggle with the fact that we're dealing with people. So armed with some of those insights from the conference and some follow-up discussions I've had on Twitter and face-to-face and things like that, I was really drawn to Peter Brennan, who's been tweeting with significant passion about the impact and engagement of human factors upon his part of the healthcare space. So I'm really delighted that when I reached out to him and asked him if he would come and join us, he's responded positively and is here today. So welcome, Peter, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Barry. It's an honour to be part of your podcast.
Thank you. And it's really great to have you here. So before we get stuck into the main topic around looking at human factors in healthcare, it'd be great to find out a bit more about you. So could you tell us a bit more about what your current role is and really what you do on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a NHS surgeon based on the South Coast in Portsmouth. I have an interest in head and neck cancer. So I basically treat everything from there to there, which includes skin cancer, salivary gland tumours, mouth cancer, throat cancer, tumours of the jaws. And of course, it's a confined space, a lot going on in that space, a lot of nerves, a lot of functions and things. So if we take parts away, then we often have to rebuild or reconstruct. So part of my role is to reconstruct as well. We can take bits of skin, bits of muscle, bits of bone from one part of the body with their little arteries and veins, and then we use microsurgery to reconstruct. So a fascinating specialty, and yeah, really enjoy it. So that's my day job. I have a personal chair in recognition of my education and research activities. And I guess the human factors is very much a hobby. I would describe it. And as I've said to you before, I feel very much an amateur in this area. It's just an interest that I have. As I say, become very passionate about it over the years, just trying to make a difference, reducing error and improving experience for healthcare teams.
I just find that entirely fascinating, the way you describe what you do in terms of you've got a very specific space, I guess, in terms of, you know, that neck up, but you're right, the intricacies involved in that, and the way you just talk about it with sort of almost casual aplomb is brilliant.
It's something that you know, takes years and years of training to get there, and I think I would never get complacent, Barry. So every operation I do, you know, I may have done it 300, 400, 500 times, but it's an individual patient there. I treat patients as if they're members of my own family, so I always go that extra mile, and I guess that's something we can talk about with engaging a checklist, for example, WHO World Health Organization checklist. You know, despite engagement with those, errors still continue to happen. Wrong site operations, wrong operations, even on the wrong patients. So, you know, really, really important Yes, it might sound a little bit just what you described, but it isn't like that at all. It's really intricate, really caring about the patient and optimizing my performance and that of the team to hopefully give the best possible outcome for patients.
It is. It's. I guess it's one of them definitions of a professional is somebody who makes something that is truly complicated, truly intricate, look and sound easy. And I just find that whole, you know, talking to the likes of yourself and your colleagues, how you can, the way that you sort of talk and engage with it, in you get to the nitty gritty of issues, whereas, you know, where we look at it for, as an amateur basis, going like, well, crikey, where do you even start? So you talk about
something like that. Definitely.
So you talked about your engagement with human factors, and I think, yes, where you describe yourself as an amateur, I think in that respect, I think we all describe ourselves as amateurs in many ways, because human factors is still a young, so it was, in fact, it was recently described as a teenage field, the teenager in amongst other disciplines. But we are all still learning all the time. So what initially sparked your interest in human factors and how you could apply it?
It was a retired airline pilot, funnily enough, who had a horrible cancer. And one of his friends was a training captain for BA, subsequently moved to EasyJet. And he always wanted to be a surgeon, and I always wanted to be an airline pilot. And he used to visit the patient regularly, and we started getting chatting, and he said, "Oh, I'd love to come into theatre." And so I facilitated that, got him into theatre. He subsequently got me on the simulators at Heathrow and Gatwick as well, which was amazing. But just offered some things. So we were operating, I think, a 5-6 hour case, which until he started coming in, I would do that, Barry, nonstop, you know. And I think about 3 hours in, he said, "Oh, have you thought about taking a break?" "No, no, of course not. Why do I need to do that?" And so over 3 or 4 visits, little things just started chipping away, and we did take the breaks. The communication improved, the crew resource management improved, and the dynamics of the team and the morale just totally changed, just literally over a few weeks. And I was amazed, actually, and I thought my own performance had improved. My operating time had reduced, even though I'd taken a break halfway through. And I guess the rest is history. I started writing a bit about it, doing a bit of reviews. Then we started looking at examiners, so Royal College of Surgeons examiners, and repetition and boredom and fatigue and all those things. And I guess, you know, it's just spiraled from there, really. And wonderful to work with some great real human factors experts and ergonomics people that that I can engage with, I can work with, I can use, if you like, and vice versa. So it's been a fantastic, fascinating journey. And I still feel like an amateur, you know. I just feel it's a hobby to me. I don't get paid anything for any of the HF stuff I do. It's all in my own time and free for the NHS. So, but at the end of the day, Barry, I think it's thinking of myself as a patient or a member of my family. What can we do in healthcare to improve safety and team performance?
So. We'll get onto back into the human factor stuff in a second, but as you said, you go through an awful lot of training, you go through an awful lot of different hurdles and stuff to get to where you are today. Can you just give us an idea about what somebody in your position, what your career path has been?
Oh, right. Okay. So my O levels were fairly mediocre. My A levels weren't particularly good. So I went into dentistry first, because in those days it was actually easier to get into dentistry than it was medicine. These days I think it's probably the other way around, because you know, dentistry is seen as a for well-being and things, you know, it's easier on work-life balance and so on. So then halfway through dentistry I thought, oh, you know what? I really want to be a doctor, and so worked really hard, picked up some honours and prizes and what have you, and then subsequently went back to medical school. Had to do the whole 5 years of medical training, and then I did 2 years in surgery, basically sort of learning general surgery, a little bit of orthopaedics. And then specialised in our specialty of oral and maxillofacial surgery. And then halfway through that, I had a research inkling. So I did an MD, which is a research higher degree. MD stands for Doctor of Medicine. So it's a two-year thesis, which is unsupervised, as opposed to a PhD, which is supervised. And that was in cancer biology. Really enjoyed that. And then became a consultant about 18 years ago now. So where's the time gone? And I think it's a little bit like driving. You know, you qualify, and then you only really start to learn the skills and judgment and when to operate and when not to operate as a consultant, really.
So you've obviously picked up your specialism and become deep specialist in your area. What influenced that decision about going down to that route? And I'm not even going to try and pronounce it. I tried to pronounce it last night to my wife, and it just doesn't roll off the tongue for me.
My mother calls it maxi facial, and I think Barry, I think the title probably needs to change. Maxilla or maxillo means jaws, and obviously facial. And I think we should be called head and neck surgeons, and perhaps merge. I mean, we work a lot with ear, nose, and throat. Colleagues that do the voice box and the back of the throat and things as well, and we do a lot of collaborative work together. So I think the title is a little confusing. People still don't quite know what we do, but I think, you know, having done medicine and qualified, and I absolutely love general surgery, and I thought, you know, I'm gonna go into vascular surgery perhaps, and then an opening came up, a registrar training program came up on the South Coast. And I thought I'd apply for that just to get a bit of experience at interview, really. And I got that post. So almost, I suppose it's fate. If you believe in fate, fate took a hand, and really enjoy the specialty. It's a lovely, you know, we do everything from cancer to facial trauma, smashed up faces, broken jaws, noses, cheekbones, and what have you, lacerations, neck lumps. The salivary gland pathology is really fascinating. There's about 50 or 60 different tumors in the saliva glands, different types. So it's a really complicated area. The neck particularly, so many structures going through the neck. So really tests one's surgical prowess, I guess, and, you know, really, really enjoy that.
Mm. That's really cool. I love the way that you talk about it with such passion.
I love it.
Obviously we come into the end maybe the end of this phase of COVID-19, the pandemic. How have you found working during that time? I mean, I assume that that you were still working all the way through, and given the domain that we're talking about, how did you find that? What was different? What did you find challenging?
So our operating, I think, stopped for about a week or 10 days while people were just getting their head around COVID. And my own practice, as I mentioned, is mainly cancer related, so that didn't really stop. And I think the terror, Barry, if I'm honest with you, the terror of going into an operating theatre, putting on the full protective equipment and the visor and the FFP3 mask, and not quite knowing what you're dealing with, it was almost like, for me, going into a theatre and there's some alien there, and you can't see it. You know, it was a terrifying experience. Yeah. And then, of course, the deaths started coming. There were some surgeons who died from COVID, ENT surgeons around the country, and of course that hits the news, and you're suddenly thinking, golly, is this going to be me? You know. Yeah. And then I think the human factor, some of the issues started to come into play, like wearing those FFP3 masks, instructions perhaps not being heard and understood, body language and reading facial expressions. So we've done quite a lot of work around that, and published on that as well. And then perhaps some of the other things that you hadn't really thought of, or certainly I hadn't thought about. So virtual online meetings, virtual exams, for example, virtual conferences, and trying to get one's head around that as well. So that's another area that we've applied HF to, and sort of published quite extensively around that, to try and help our colleagues get better experiences online. So both the clinical and the ramifications. COVID hasn't gone away, and of course now we've got monkeypox that seems to be spurting up. Yeah.
So I guess is there anything around the COVID-19 that the ways of working there that you actually thought, actually, that's made us work better? I mean, from my perspective, it's things like, you know, not having to travel everywhere for meetings and being able to utilize, you know, technology like this to do it. But is there anything from your perspective that actually has been, actually, that this has been for quite a traumatic experience, has been quite a significant win?
Yeah, I think team working has become even more apparent. And as I mentioned just a minute ago, effective communication. So making sure that your message is heard and understood by the team, using repeat back and so forth, taking those regular breaks and actually looking after ourselves and the wider team, and actually getting people looking out for you. That's something that we seem to have developed. So I think during the pandemic, huge amounts of sort of tiredness and fatigue on an individual and an NHS basis, but coming out of it, so many lessons learned, and I think the NHS is stronger as a result.
That's really good to hear. The fact that, I mean, that was something that was really apparent during the recent ergonomics conferences, that nobody seems to have, certainly in the research field and this type of thing, has sort of stepped back and said, you know, COVID, we'll get through it, blah, blah, blah. There's been a whole bunch of, right, this is significant. What do we learn from about this going forward? And therefore, how can we improve ourselves as a result, which I think is fantastic. We're just going to take a quick break, and then we're going to go come back and really have that more generic chat about human factors within healthcare. So we'll be right back after this.
You are listening to 1202, the Human Factors Podcast. We wanted to take the opportunity to say thank you for your support. You can help further by rating us through your podcast provider, sharing us through social media, and telling your friends and colleagues. Let's work together in raising awareness of the value in putting users at the center of what we do.
And welcome back. I'm here with Peter Brennan to talk about the application of human factors within healthcare. So, Peter, what do you think at that high level? What are the issues around human factors in healthcare from your perspective?
I think they're multifactorial. There's a whole culture issue with healthcare, and you know, there has been a blame culture in a sense, and people feel uneasy about speaking up, as opposed to a just culture, which we're certainly aspiring to, and organisations such as the Care Quality Commission and government say that we should have a just culture. And those of you who don't know what that means, it's basically, yes, we're all accountable for our individual actions, but unless you go to work wanting to cause harm, which sadly a minority do, and you'll be aware of Harold Shipman, and Patterson was another one, a surgeon. When error happens, we need to be looking at learning lessons rather than apportioning blame. So I think that's a big issue in healthcare, and that may well take a generation to change, if I'm honest with you. And people just don't feel able to speak up because they're worried about repercussions, they're worried about their own careers, what might happen, and so on.
So if we're going to go into that then, and if anybody's wanting to hear more about just culture, then there is a previous episode in the back catalogue that we talk a bit about just culture, which I'd thoroughly recommend, obviously. But I guess for me, where I struggle with this, now we sort of mentioned it right really early on, is healthcare. The healthcare system is, it's all about people. It's about making people better, or in people in less pain and things like that. But when we see these things going on within the healthcare system, it seems to forget people are people. You know, we all have our foibles, we all have our own characteristics. We forget things. We just seem to forget that. Is that, why is it so difficult to get this implemented? Is it just a UK thing, or is it worldwide, or what? What's your thoughts on that?
No, I mean, I've spoken and been invited all over the world, so as far away as New Zealand, Asia, Taiwan, the US, Canada, and so on. And it seems to be the same issues, Barry, all over. I think for me, and perhaps this is where I might differ in my own understanding of human factors compared to the human factors experts and the ergonomics experts that talk about systems and what have you. And yes, systems are really, really important and things, but for me, the clue's in the title. And so as humans, all of us are, we work both as individuals and as part of the wider group. And the NHS is an enormous machine. I think it's the biggest employer in the UK with 1.1 million people. It is under-resourced. I mean, let's be honest. People go off sick, and the service carries on. You would never have that, for example, in aviation. If one or two cabin crew go off sick, then the flight's cancelled unless they can be replaced. You cannot compare aviation and the NHS, of course, but it's an enormous machine. And I think, sadly, managers and others look at numbers. So they look at the number of patients waiting or the number of patients that need to be seen in a clinic rather than that human element and the fact you have to break bad news and tell patients they have a cancer. And so on, and you can't do that in 2 or 3 minutes. You know, that takes half an hour, for example, to do that. So it is a people thing, very much as you've said, Barry, I think. But just such an enormous organisation, and there's going to be different areas within each of it. So for example, in surgery, we have teams. We often work with different members of the team, different anaesthetists, and so on, and coming together quickly to form a cohesive and safe team, and I think that's an area where we can learn a lot from other high reliability organisations. And I think you only have to look at the rail industry. I mean, your own defence organisations and things—they are highly safe, highly reliable organisations. If you look at healthcare, for example, it's called a high reliability organisation, but 1 in 20 hospital admissions has some form of error.
Right.
Of those 1 in 20, another 1 in 20, so that's 1 in 400 admissions, has a serious medical or surgical error. And most of those errors are preventable by HF application and understanding some of the many things we talk about. So I think putting yourself in now as a patient, if you come to see a consultant in a hospital, Barry, you have about a 1 in 400 chance of having a serious medical or surgical error, and that's really scary statistic, isn't it? That's terrifying.
I haven't quite heard it like that before, and I am now terrified. You're right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've got to admit, after we'd had the conference this year, I then went into hospital just for to get some blood taken, so a blood test. And it wasn't until it sort of been highlighted in these discussions that we'd had that I realised just how much human factors needs to play a part. Because, I mean, just taking from a simple example of walking into the hospital and knowing I had to go and go to the phlebotomy area, I had no way of knowing where to go. There was no... If you're in and around the hospital all the time, presume you will know where to go because it's your thing. But for me, who doesn't go in very often, and even less if I can help it, then there was no simple way of working out, you know, A to B. Happily, my wife was with me; she knew where to go. But then you even got to the door, and there was literally so many signs on the door saying "Do this, do that, do this, do that, do that." I was like, I had no idea in which order to read them, which order to do, which was most important, which was just there for the staff, which was just for me. And even, so, just from that perspective, I was like, "Wow, there is so much information overload. There is so much going on, but none of it was malicious. None of it is nasty. People are just trying to do their job." But I think, as you've highlighted, it's such a complicated organisation that I've got a massive amount of respect for it, but I also just want to kind of get hold of it and shake it a bit and do stuff, which, I mean, from the work that you're doing, you seem to be doing that.
Well, I think if I'm honest with you, and firstly, can I just ask you and the audience, how do you feel when you go into that hospital waiting to have your blood test or your CT scan? You know, most of us will be scared, mm-hmm. apprehensive, the fear of the unknown, worried, concerned about what the results might be. So you have all those elements on top of your normal thinking process, and we talk about bandwidth as well, and you know things, and you've probably only got a few 5 to 7 things you can think of. So having that fear, for example, does change. And only today I was breaking some bad news to a family, and one of the family members became extremely aggressive towards me, and of course I'm never going to become aggressive back to them. Yeah. It was all about calming the situation down, and afterwards they apologized and said, look, I'm so sorry. It's like, no, you don't need to be sorry. I understand how you feel, you know, you're anxious and you're worried and what have you, and yes. So I think Barry, the key to this is working with experts like yourself, but also working with us, you know, as healthcare providers and deliverers, because we understand the dynamics of surgical team working or medical team working or phlebotomy working. We might not understand the systems processes and system design, but that's where we come together. And actually sort of coming together, you kind of get that synergism. So I bring a little bit of expertise, you bring a huge amount of expertise, but putting us together, we achieve just so much more. And that, I think, is where the future lies. I mean, they're talking about having human factors experts in every hospital, or human factors champions. Yeah. All the hospitals that I speak to, there isn't anyone in post as yet, and whether that person is a human factors expert or an ergonomics or a clinician, or probably what you need is both, actually. Mm. That's what I would suggest. And so you have that fertile ground between us.
Yeah, you almost want the because say I was to come in and do that sort of role, I would still, and in fact I've seen it actually work quite well, where I've got no idea about what I'm walking into. It means you can ask stupid questions and say, right, why are you doing this? I do find that quite a useful tool to do. But you're right, you need that partnership, because the surgical expert or the clinician expert will, you know, be able to open doors for you to be able to translate the language. Because
And I think one of the things, you know, there's quite a few airline pilots, for example, that run their own human factors courses and whatever you, mm. and that's absolutely great. But most of them have probably never been into an operating theatre, and so they're kind of translating what their perception is. But they need to be working with surgeons, with radiologists, whatever specialty, and actually understand those issues. So a lot of these things are translatable, yes, but you need that expertise both in ergonomics and human factors, and us as deliverers.
Well, that certainly feels like the sort of challenge or the panacea that we need to aim for and do something about. How do we make that happen? I think we definitely need to make that happen. But so we talked about, I guess, the negative side of things, and it's positively probably a bit bad to do that, because have you seen where human factors had a positive impact in your surgical teams?
So I think, as I've said to you, a lot of my work is probably what one might call crew resource management. So it's actually managing the team, managing the crew. And we've had so many amazing feedback stories from colleagues that actually do take the break. And I would always say, Barry, you know, would you drive from London to Scotland nonstop? And I use that in my HF teaching, and everyone looks around. It's like, no, I stop after 3 or 4 hours. It's like, but hang on, but you operate for 8 hours nonstop. Yes, yeah, that's the cult. That's what I've always done. Have you ever thought about stopping? No, I haven't. I don't need to, because that's what. Well, please just take a break. Just see how you get on. And even cardiologists, you know, heart specialists that were doing 6-7 hour ward rounds without stopping for lunch and things. And then I've said to them, look, why don't you do this and actually try it? And the number of emails that have come, all from around the world, like, oh, Peter, you're an absolute genius. You know, we took your advice. You know, everyone's so much happier. We're so much more efficient. wards round of the operation was finished much quicker. And of course, one's performance stays high as well. So analysis and decision-making, you start talking about cognitive performance and so on. Just obvious, basic things. So I think people are waking up to that and realizing the importance of looking after ourselves. And so I would always use that analogy, you know, the oxygen mask on the airplanes. Put your own mask on before helping others. Optimize your own performance before looking after your patients. And it seems to be gaining more and more traction, almost on a daily basis. Actually, it's absolutely incredible.
So I think, and do correct me if I'm wrong, but there is, or certainly has been, almost a that hierarchical, almost leadership-driven structure within the NHS, particularly amongst doctors and surgeons like yourself, where we talk about just culture, but historically, you know, nobody would question, say, somebody in your position, and that type of thing. So presumably that's what you're trying to change, the ability for people to shout up and things like that.
Yeah. So culture is, I think we mentioned at the start, it could take a generation to change, couldn't it, really? But that steep hierarchy, yes, there has to be hierarchy, of course, because there has to be a leader, a consultant surgeon, an airline captain, head of the train or whatever it is. That yes, there has to be, but there has to be sufficiently shallow that anyone can challenge you. And so for me, I set that up at the brief stage, and I will actually say at the brief, even if it's with people we've worked with all the time, look, please, if you have any concerns, if there's anything you're not sure about, please just stop me. And then we're going to, as long as it's safe to do so, and I haven't put a hole in a major blood vessel and someone's bleeding out. Fortunately, that doesn't happen often, but just in case your listeners are going to be wondering who on earth is this fellow, but 99.9% of the time, you can stop, you can step back, listen to the concerns or whatever. And I think it's the people that don't do that because they see themselves on a pedestal or whatever, and that's where one can run into problems. And there's many examples of wrong operations being done. The wrong kidney was removed a few years ago because a medical student spotted it but felt unable to speak up. And in fact, they did speak up, but they were put down by the consultant. The wrong kidney was removed, patient died. Absolutely tragic, you know. So we've published quite a bit about hierarchy, including in the British Medical Journal, which has a huge readership. So I think all of that, and it kind of weaves into other areas which are probably not human factors per se, are they? Things like respect and civility. I don't think they're human factors. They're just common things that one should implement. But having that civility to the rest of the team, having the respect of everyone in the team, so you respect everyone equally, and hopefully then they'll respect you back, rather than having this hierarchy that I'm only going to speak to another consultant, I'm not going to speak to the cleaner, I'm not going to do this. That's not a way to build a good team.
So how do you? I mean, I would argue that they are human factors issue because they fit within that organisational how you run the organisation. But I fully get that, you know, different people have different flavours on that.
Yeah.
But the so how do you drive that sort of behaviour going forward? Then is it just by you setting a good example, or you've already highlighted you talk to a lot of people around the world about this. So is it you evangelizing about this, or?
Yeah, I guess so. So I think as with a lot of human factors integration, it's a kind of top-down culture. So government, our regulator, for example, the General Medical Council, I've worked with them. I've published with the regulator. And then you've got the bottom-up, so the deliverers of healthcare. And you kind of meet somewhere in the middle, one would hope. But it's about kind of seeing the change. And people think a lot of this doesn't apply to them because they've never had a problem or what have you. And then I would always go to them and say, well, have you asked the team what they think about you, or, you know, what their relationship is? No, why would I do that? It's like, well, could you just go back to your team and say, look, how do you perceive me? If people are honest, then sometimes they come back, oh, he's an ogre, or she's difficult, or he's objectionable, or what have you. So Yeah, so I think gradual erosion, perhaps chipping away. You know, we publish loads. Webinars, seminars. We've just set up an online human factors course for the Royal College of Surgeons of England. That's just about to go live. 5 modules: just culture, threat and error management, situation awareness, effective team working, including hierarchy, and effective communication. So I'm just going around knocking on every single door I can. And as I say, this is a great opportunity, Barry, to talk to fellows and members of your fantastic institution. You know, it's lovely contacting you enough.
Yeah, we need more effectively ambassadors like what you're doing. You're being that discipline ambassador, which I think personally I think is fantastic, and we need more of it. So just don't stop what you're doing.
Oh, that's very kind. I mean, I do get criticised by some human factors experts. You know, I've been criticised even on social media, on Twitter, about my PhD on human factors, which again was something I did 3 or 4 years ago. And I was questioned who my examiners were, an airline pilot, a professor of surgery, and a psychologist. And it's like, well, they're not human factors experts, was the response. And it's like, well, maybe they're not according to your definition, but they are living and breathing and they're working and they understand human factors in healthcare and aviation and what have you. So, but as I said right at the start, we need to be working together and valuing each other equally. So I have the utmost respect for you and your colleagues, and hopefully they will have the same respect for us as deliverers. And that fertile ground between us, that's where we can make a massive difference, I think.
No, I couldn't agree more, and I think the more we can do in this space, the better. And we are a broad church. There's nobody holds that one thing of being the expert. So I would refute that quite strongly. Just to change tack slightly, obviously, as I said from the off, I'm a big tech geek, and I'm really into things like AI and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Obviously, AI and technology is making stronger and stronger incursions into the healthcare sector. Where do you see that impacting what you do, and how do you see the influence of human factors evolving in what you do?
So I think artificial intelligence is something I don't really understand, if I'm honest with you, but it's being used increasingly to, for example, look at CT scans and to, you know, it can rapidly go through CT scans or mammograms, for example, having screening mammograms for breast cancer. It can very, very quickly assess and give you what it thinks is the outcome. So I think it's evolving all the time. I think it's an exciting area. And definitely something that we have to live with and embrace. In terms of technology, for me, probably one of the greatest technologies in surgery is robotics. And it is absolutely incredible what the robot can do. It can, you know, its hand is 15 or 20 times smaller than your hand. You can turn it to go round and upside down and backwards and forwards and what have you. And the surgery is done using a console. There's usually a surgeon and maybe an assistant. Everything's up on the screen. And the amazing thing, Barry, about this is that it uses the internet. So a surgeon could be working in one hospital and they've taught a surgeon in another hospital who's subsequently working in Australia, for example, and they run into difficulties. And, you know, a quick phone call or whatever, they can then log on to that robot remotely. And even though they're on the console working in London, they can actively do that operation or help that colleague out. I think that is absolutely incredible, and that actually happens. You know, so that's unprecedented, isn't it? Really, you know, having that ability to be able to help a colleague 10,000 miles away without having to fly there and what have you. Yes, it does have limited use, so it can't be used for everything. There's a lot of neurosurgery, for example, head and neck surgery. It has limited use at the moment, but I think robotics is absolutely incredible. It minimises operative stay, it reduces the incisions and so on, and the outcomes so much better as well. So. That for me, I kind of wish I was a robotic surgeon sometimes, but actually, that does bring the human factors into play, because the surgeon looks down the console, so they become very tunnel visioned in terms of what they're doing, looking at the operation. And speaking with them, and we're just starting to start up some research now, they become totally unaware of everyone else in the room because they're looking down this console. So they lose track of time very, very quickly. 2, 3, 4 hours can go past, and it feels like 5 or 10 minutes. So having that wider team working, having that the situation awareness, a team looking out for them, looking at the clock, setting that up at the briefing stage, saying, look, when we get to 3 hours, let's just take a break. And of course, because they're not scrubbed, Barry, as well, they can literally just down tools.
Right, yeah.
If it's say, just walk out of theatre, take a cup of tea or coffee, everyone can relax for a little while, come back, and then you've optimised your performance again. And I mean, little things like, I don't know if you know, but if you lose a kilogram of body weight due to water loss, so particularly in the summer, it was a particular issue with PPE, of course. Mm-hmm. But if you lose a kilogram in body weight, your analysis and decision making falls by 20%. And of course, that happens so slowly, you don't even know it's happening. Mm-hmm. So really slow deterioration. So the importance of hydration, of eating, of taking the breaks, really helps your concentration.
Mm. There is an element there around the robotics thing absolutely fascinates me. And there is a slight, I do get a slightly nervous twitch as well, having been around the sort of the cybersecurity domain as well, of, what happens if somebody hacks it? But fundamentally, that idea that somebody's doing something, that they run into a problem, they can call up not only just help, but the best help for that position, that role, that time. And then they can go in and say, actually, do this, do that, do the other, is mind-blowing. And it's just so good. Though, is there an element there that actually, would you, going back to like the people skills, anxiety and things like that, I guess you'd want to make sure that, that patients go to sleep before they see the operating theatre if it's just basically covered in robotic arms at that point. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. It's interesting,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah. So I think there's two things. One is the ego side of things, and historically there has been some big egos in medicine and surgery particularly, and there's almost like a hierarchy, or there's been a hierarchy of different surgical specialties with some surgeons thinking they're better than others and what have you. So that needs to go, and that does go in terms of robotics, because if someone calls you and you're the best person to do it, and you happen to be 200 miles away and you can help them, fantastic. For me, it's all about what's best for the patient. We're here for the patients. We're ambassadors for the patient. Patients put their trust, their lives, their head and neck, their limb, whatever, into our hands. And so we have to do everything to give them the best possible outcome. Mm.
No, that's really cool. And I think seeing, that does spawn a whole lot of issues that would be really worth, interesting to investigate, like handover and stuff like that. But if you had one human factors wish, something that you could implement tomorrow and just with a click of the fingers, what do you think that would be?
I think it probably would be just culture across the NHS, and coupled with that, safe and effective reporting. So Cicero, I tweeted a couple of days ago about Cicero, great Roman orator. I think he was assassinated though, actually. But he said that that anyone can err, anyone can make a mistake, and that's absolutely true, isn't it? We make 5 or 7 mistakes every single day, but only a fool persists in error. And I think for me in healthcare, the same errors keep on happening time after time after time. So unlike other industries where errors happen, mistakes, and it goes around the world, as it did with, for example, the 737 MAX with those fatal things. It goes around the world. In healthcare, just the same errors in every single hospital. And part of this is actually due to this just culture, because people feel unable to speak up and are unable to raise concerns and things as well. So I think for me, having a just culture, as there now is in aviation, and I gather from my from my pilot friends, this has taken almost a generation to implement as well. So we are a long way behind other organisations. Yeah,
but I still think that Just Culture is still... we'd like to think it was a lot more implemented than it is. But I think in all organisations, we've still got a long way to go, because you're right, we still want to... When things go wrong, you still want to blame somebody. And fundamentally, it is, yeah. You want to get, you want somebody to be gripped for whatever's gone wrong, which, you know, but then we, I think people do take into the, go too far the other way and think, well, Just Culture is a, you know, nobody gets to blame, and that's not true either. Just to change gears slightly, because I think that's been a really in-depth review around the use of HF within the healthcare sector, though I do feel we could probably go on and talk for another couple of hours on this, because I think there's so many different interesting pieces that have come up.
But that's human factors, because your listeners will be getting to that 45-minute stage, starting to think, hang on, when's this going to finish? You know, I want a break. You know, so you have to think about that as well. So we need to finish.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we'll start cruising into that with the final three questions. So, brilliant. Do you have a book or a paper or anything like that that you go back and use repeatedly, time and time again? It could be technical, it could be a fiction book, but is there something there that you recommend to others?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think for this event then on human factors, so I have loads of medical books. I've written seven textbooks myself, actually, and which are widely used. But I think for human factors, the resource that I absolutely love is the Civil Aviation Authority handbook for airline crew. It's called CAP 737, freely available to download. And you could almost replace a lot of the wording. So if it says airline crew, you could actually put healthcare into the majority of that book, written by Steve Jarvis, who's a fellow of your institution. I love that book. It takes you through analysis and decision making. It takes you through illusions, threat and error management, situation awareness, communication, and so on. And I read it, and every time I read it, I get a new idea, Barry, if I'm honest with you. So a lot of my ideas come from that from that resource. So if you haven't seen it, please do have a look. I love it. Oh. In fact, there's a new edition coming, I gather.
Oh, well, there you go. You heard it here first. If you could go back to a younger version of yourself, be that, say, 16 or 18, or you pick an appropriate age, what advice, is there a bit of advice you would give yourself that would help you do what you're doing now?
I think work-life balance is really, really critical. And you know, this is someone who's written what, 700 papers and all these textbooks and things over and above my busy job. So are you talking to the right person here? But I think you know, that nirvana moment came for me probably about 5-10 years ago. It's, are you living to work or working to live? And I think there has to be perhaps an element of both, but just the importance of life outside of work, quality time with your family and friends, recharging yourself, the importance of well-being, and so on. And that does feed in, I guess, indirectly into HF as well, doesn't it? If you're constantly doing your emails at 11 o'clock at night and things, you never really switch off. So actually having some time away from work, I set up my out of office if I'm on leave and things, say I'm actually away, I'm not going to reply to emails, and in fact I don't, Barry, I just walk away from that. Otherwise we become slaves to it, and we never take that time to have the quality family time, rest and recuperation, and just enjoy ourselves. Really important. And unfortunately I've been guilty of that throughout my training, working long hours, doing all this extra stuff that I've been doing, and still continue to do it, I must say, but but actually giving myself protected time on the weekends, Friday night, for example, that's it. You know, I walk away from work, and unless I'm on call, that's it. You know, no work until Monday. Not every weekend, but as often as I can.
No, certainly that Friday afternoon around 6-7 o'clock, then there's nothing going to get in between me and my bottle of wine. But I think that's really good, that whole... It's one of these things that I do tell other people. I tell my staff when I do it. You know, you need to take that time off. You need to look after you. But I'm terrible at doing it. So yeah, I see exactly where you're coming from.
And even you know, even with family and friends and things, you can change hierarchies, and I'm not even sure that's the right word to use, but you know, you can say to your spouse, right, we've agreed that I'm going to do this, or you're not going to work, right, this is it, and actually call it. And your children as well, you know, my eldest daughter is a 19-year-old medical student who incidentally has started to do some human factors work in the medical school. It's fantastic.
Awesome.
And she will actually sort of tell me, right, Dad, come on, you've got to stop working now. And it's like, okay, you know, and because I've empowered her, then it's like, okay, I'm really sorry. Yeah. Okay. You're absolutely right.
That's really important. Cool. Yeah, that really goes back to what you said earlier about, you know, having that the people around you and having the ability to take to listen and things like that.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Who would you, you know, given what you talk about your experience, who do you suggest I interview next? Who would you like to hear me interview?
Well, you know what, I think Steve Jarvis, who's the author of that CAP 737. He's the HF expert who helps us with the Royal College of Surgeons online course, and now he's helping us with a face-to-face human factors course, which will be coming out early part of next year. I think he really understands the ergonomics, he understands the systems and things. He says to me that all of his work, probably every minute there's an airline pilot somewhere in the world using some of his systems work and things. So amazing guy, but he really understands healthcare and the expertise that we have, and immensely respectful of us as I am of him. So I think he would be a great person to get maybe the other side, perhaps as an expert in ergonomics who understands healthcare, perhaps as I'm an expert surgeon, if that's the right word, and just with an interest in human factors.
Yes, no, that,
an amateur.
That's I shall go and hunt him down. Peter, thank you ever so much for being for giving us your insights and your honest appraisal of where you think things are today in the health sector. I think you do yourself down quite a lot. I don't think you're an enthusiastic amateur. You've clearly got a lot of expertise. You've clearly got a lot of experiences that we need to learn from for you. So thank you ever so much for giving us your insight.
Well, thank you very much. What an absolute honor it is. And, you know, let's work together on this and see and crank things up. It's an amazing opportunity, I think. So thank you very much, Barry. Really appreciate it.
And thank you for listening and watching this episode. I hope you found it insightful and useful. If you want to get in touch with Peter around some of the things you've heard today, he's, as he said, he's on social media, and you can find his details on the 1202.com 1202podcast.com website, where his details are there alongside this episode. If you want to help others find this content and other content that we've developed alongside it, there are two really simple things you can do. You can give us a 5-star review wherever you're consuming this episode. That's free for you to do and quick and easy. That helps other people find it when they're searching for it, either through their search engines or whatever. Secondly, you can tell your friends and colleagues and encourage them to give us a try and see what they think of our content. There is a whole range of episodes that we do, everything from medical content, as we're hearing now, to just culture, all the way through to the importance of sleep and some of the other topics well in between of that. But as for now, we'll see you on the next episode of 1202.
Thank you for listening to 1202, the Human Factors Podcast. Please do get in touch with your thoughts, questions and comments. You can contact us on social media such as Twitter, LinkedIn and Facebook at 1202 Podcast. See you next time. And remember, it's more than just common sense.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.